True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Full-time mom, Candy Montgomery, always did what was expected of her. She married, had two kids, and taught Sunday school at her church. Her husband, Pat, loved her, and she loved him. But something was missing from Candy's life. Excitement. She took creative writing classes in order to express herself. She made some close women friends to whom she could confide over a glass of wine and share her wildest desires. But still, something was lacking. Maybe an extramarital affair was the answer.
Are you kidding me? Yeah, so I've done all this stuff to provide more excitement for my life, and there's still something lacking. So I think I'll have an affair. That will do it.
That would add excitement to her life.
Among other things.
She looked at it like just some sexual exploration while Pat was away at work. Nothing that would hurt anyone. Because Candy, she wasn't the type of person to hurt anyone. Betty Gore didn't share Candy's urges to find pleasure outside of her marriage. She adored her husband, Alan, who made a good living and worked hard to keep her happy. Keeping Betty happy wasn't an easy task. She suffered from depression and hypochondria. She was very insecure. She cried when he had to travel for work, even if it was just for a day or two. She just did not do well on her own. She invested her time and effort into her marriage, signing them up for the church's Marriage Encounter program. And it was working for them. They were closer than ever. How did the lives of these two suburban moms intersect with a shocking and brutal axe murder in the middle of a normal afternoon? Join us at the Quiet End for an extraordinary story of love, lust, and rage in the suburbs. Unleashed Rage, The Murder of Betty Gore.
So I have a Texas beer called Pumpkinator, brewed by St. Arnold Brewing Company in Houston. Now it's a pumpkin ale, as you might have guessed from the name on the label. And these are usually fall seasonals. And I know it's almost winter, but I wanted to get this little shelf turret out of my fridge and drink it up.
Okay.
So pumpkin ales are quite variable. They can be brewed with hand-cut pumpkin or pumpkin puree or just pumpkin flavoring. They also tend to be fairly spiced with ginger, nutmeg, cloves, cinnamon, allspice, not necessarily all at once. And there's a good solid malt background without any hop bitterness. So Pumpkinator is a dark brown ale with a medium-sized head. There's a lot of spice in the aroma, and try as I might, I had a tough time noticing any pumpkin in there. Now, when I taste it, a lot of spice again, cinnamon, some cloves, some nutmeg, and yeah, there's a little bit of pumpkin. So you probably figure out where I'm going with this. It's not a very good pumpkin beer.
We're not going in a positive direction.
No, we're not. Plus, it's a 10% alcohol by volume, and I think that there's a fair amount of alcohol in the taste that kind of intrudes on it. So.
Yeah, that's not a sign of a good beer.
I'm not liking this beer too much.
Okay.
But it's out of my fridge.
Yes. And you drank it. I mean, what
does
it take?
Of course.
What does it take for a beer to be bad enough so you won't drink it? What beer would you pour down the sink? Because I've never seen it happen, I don't think.
No, I have never drain poured.
So you'll drink it. You'll persevere.
Yeah, I suppose if it was an infected beer, say some bad bacteria got in and the taste was so bad, then I might pour it. But in my years of beer drinking, I've never drain poured.
Even if you go to someone's house and it's like a Coors or a Miller Lite, you'll finish it.
Of course.
You're a trooper.
I would do that anyway because I'm a guest in this person's home. And I'm not going to be a dickhead and pour a beer that he's offered me.
Okay. All right. Let's open the beer and then we'll head on down to the Quiet End.
Okay.
It doesn't look like a bad beer.
No, It's a nice looking beer.
Yeah.
It just was a little lacking. It was a little too boozy and it's a little too, I don't know how to say it. Not enough pumpkin. How's that? Too much booze, not enough pumpkin.
Okay. But you're not embarrassed to take it down to the quiet end because there are a few people here today.
Oh, I'm not embarrassed at all.
Okay, good.
Just not one of my favorite beers.
Right. Okay. Well, did you notice that department store Santa is back?
And he's pounding them down, isn't he?
Well, it's a rough time of year for him. Kids are coming in like clockwork.
Yeah, I see him sitting there, and I'm always reminded of Billy Bob Thornton in Bad Santa.
I know.
Although he doesn't look like Billy Bob. And he's not as wasted as Billy Bob.
Well, nobody's as wasted. Yeah. I mean, Billy Bob plays wasted better than anyone.
Yeah, he sure does.
Yeah. But I have to say, Bad Santa 2, awful. Awful. We didn't even make it through it.
We did not. We watched, what, half an hour?
Maybe.
And
so
said,
bad.
Nah.
No.
I wonder whose idea that was.
I don't know. I mean, they probably made some money off of it.
Well, they did Bad Santa, the original, did pretty well.
Well, it's in our collection of Christmas movies to watch every year. I enjoy that.
Well, and Bad Santa 2 is not going to make the cut.
No, no. I just think, what was the boy's name? Merman Thurman or something? Thurman Merman?
Yeah, Thurman something.
He's not cute anymore. He's an adult. They should have got another kid.
They should have, but they couldn't.
Well, he could have met another kid. They could have had a new story with a new kid.
Yeah.
Would have been better.
No, but they had to continue the same storyline.
Well, it was terrible.
It was.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go on down there and get started.
Okay. So Candy Montgomery arrived at the United Methodist Church of Lucas, Texas. This is a Dallas suburb. At 9 o'clock on Friday, June 13th, 1980. It was a hot, oppressive day, as most days in the summer are in Texas. And it was the last day of vacation Bible school. So Candy drove one of those big family station wagons like the one Chevy Chase drove in the vacation movies. Her six-year-old daughter ran to play with her best friend Alyssa Gore, and her younger son Ian made his way to the church. They were going to have a special lunch and puppet show to celebrate the last day with parents, which meant Candy had extra work to do. So Jenny had harassed her until she agreed that Alyssa could spend the night if it was okay with her mom. Girls had had a sleepover the previous night, and Candy usually didn't allow two sleepovers in a row. But she agreed to ask Alyssa's mom, Betty, if Alyssa could go to see The Empire Strikes Back with their family, the Montgomery family, and stay over after that. Now, it was kind of an inconvenience because it would mean that she had to take Alyssa to her afternoon swimming lesson. So she planned to help with the lunch, go to the store to buy Father's Day cards, and she had promised to lend a card table to a friend in nearby Fairview. So Alyssa told Candy that her swimsuit was still at home, so that meant she'd have to drive to the Gore house and pick it up. And this is in addition to all the other errands that she's running. So sounds like she's a little bit on the stress side there.
Yeah.
A lot of things going.
Right. Now, after teaching the day's parable, Candy and the children bowed their heads in prayer, and another volunteer took over teaching. That was at 9:30, and Candy went to do some clerical tasks. She was quite involved. When she arrived in the kitchen, Candy found Barbara Green preparing the Kool-Aid and cookies for the children's 10:30 recess. Candy and Barbara were quite friendly. Barbara's husband, Phil, worked with Candy's husband, Pat, at Texas Instruments. Barbara was much more reserved than Candy, but Candy felt comfortable confiding in her, even as she kind of envied Barbara's unquestioning faith. Candy told Barbara about her family's plans to see the new Star Wars film that night. After helping set up the Kool-Aid glasses, Candy said she was leaving to get Alyssa's swimsuit and get permission for the sleepover from Alyssa's mom, Betty. Then she would run by Target and get some Father's Day cards for the children to give to Pat. Then she'd be back in time for the puppet show. The church was in a small farming community called Lucas. The church itself sat on a hill surrounded by wheat fields. Most of the families in the area weren't farmers. They were young people who'd moved to escape the city and the expensive housing in Dallas. The big electronics companies were within 20 to 30 minutes commute, so that's where a lot of people worked.
Right. So these little area, little places are like bedroom communities, right?
Right.
You know, they're upwardly mobile people are living there and commuting into Dallas for their jobs.
Exactly.
So Candy didn't call the Gore house before she left the church. She sometimes avoided talking to Betty Gore any more than necessary, because Betty could be distant and cold and even unfriendly.
Yeah, she wasn't one of the girls like the other
women. No, she wasn't. Now, Candy knew that if Alyssa didn't go to the movies with them, Betty would probably never take her, because that's just the way Betty is. So once at the house, Candy parked out in front in the street. She took her purse from the seat behind her and walked up to the front door of the Gore family home. Back at the church, meanwhile, the children are getting ready for the 11 o'clock assembly. An hour and a half later, several mothers arrived to watch the second assembly. When it was little Ian's turn to do his part in the Noah's Ark show, volunteer Marie Childs noticed that Candy still had not returned.
Now, Candy left the Gore house with her purse and her keys in her hands. A toe on her left foot was throbbing and bleeding heavily. She reminded herself of the Father's Day cards and the puppet show. She was kind of shaken, and she knew she needed to remain calm and get back to the church. Driving toward Plano, Candy glanced down at her legs, and she saw that her jeans were soaking wet. She drove to her house, drove into the attached two-car garage, and entered through the unlocked door into the house. Once inside, she bolted up the stairs and stripped off her blouse and jeans. In the bathroom, she grabbed a package of Band-Aids and wrapped her toe as tightly as she could. The cut was deeper than she thought, and she had to wipe away blood with toilet paper several times before the Band-Aids would stick.
So we're already getting the idea that something happened at Betty's house.
So Candy soaked her blouse in the kitchen sink with water and detergent, and she had this feeling like she might throw up, but she was in a hurry and she knew she had things to do. She found a pair of jeans that was a similar shade to the ones she'd removed and took them with her into the bathroom. She took a quick shower, shampooing her hair, and she felt a gash at her hairline on the right side of her forehead. Now, when she got out of the shower, she tried to put a Band-Aid on that, but it wouldn't stick because her hair was right there. So she just put some pressure on it with a towel. She put on the new jeans, threw the old ones in the washer, wrung out the wet blouse, threw it in the dryer, and she thought to herself, well, it's a good thing it's a dark burgundy-colored blouse.
Yes, hide the stains.
Before heading back to the church, she traded in her rubber sandals for a pair of blue gym shoes. Mothers were getting ready to leave the church when Candy arrived, and Jenny, Candy's daughter, was looking for her. Candy jumped out of her station wagon and ran into Barbara Green, and she hurriedly told Barbara that she had got to chatting with Betty Gore, and then she looked at her watch, and she thought she still had enough time to run to Target. Then she drove all the way to Plano before she realized that her watch had stopped, and she was late, so she didn't even bother to go in the store. She came right back to the church, and she said she was so upset because she wanted to see the children's performance.
Yeah, so Candy repeated this story to two more of the mothers who were there. And as she's talking, she started pouring iced tea into the glasses from a pitcher. So she's kind of calm and collected.
Yeah, by all reports, she seemed pretty normal.
The women sat at one table and the children at another. Now, Candy had to excuse herself and leave the room because the cut on her forehead was continuing to ooze and she had to keep dabbing at it. Now, nobody said anything about that.
No, I think she had that frizzy hair that kind of covered it.
Yeah.
The rest of the day was disorienting for her as she completed her errands with the kids. But they did keep her distracted. They stopped at a Walmart for the Father's Day cards, and she bought the kids some chocolate bars. When they got back to the house, Candy gave Alyssa her suit and told her to change for her swimming lesson. Then she called Pat at work and repeated her story about Betty Gore and the Target trip and the watch. Before hanging up, she asked Pat if he knew where Alan Gore was working that day, but Pat didn't know. Candy thought Alan would be getting home from work about 5:15 that evening, and then he would find his wife Betty. Alyssa had a baby sister who'd been napping while Candy was there, so it was kind of important for someone to come home.
Something bad happened at the Gore house, and we're going to find that out. So back at the Gore house, no one came by that afternoon. Because it turns out that Alan was going to go on a business trip. Phone rang a few times and went unanswered. Alan was about to board the plane from Dallas to Minnesota when he called the house to check in. There was no answer. Inside the house, the baby was screaming off and on for hours and hours. The two Cocker Spaniels were in the backyard and they were barking and whining. In the utility room, Betty Gore had laid dead in there for hours.
So let's go back on Candy's childhood a little bit, where Candy's coming from. As a child, she'd been blonde, petite, and quite adorable, so she was used to getting attention. And she was already a bit of a flirt in kindergarten. She had a crush on a few different boys. She was the daughter of an Army radar technician, and as a result, she attended 7 or 8 schools by the time she finished high school. Candy had a lot of boyfriends, and she learned about sex from her older sister. She ran away from home when she was 14, mostly out of boredom. She hated school and started dating early. At 16, she lost her virginity to a boy she'd been seeing for a couple of months. Now, Candy was set up with Pat Montgomery by his mother, who worked with Candy at a furniture factory. Candy had decided that she wanted to get married. Her dream was to live on a farm and have at least 8 children. Now, Pat seemed really boring at first, but after getting to know him, she realized he was smart and sweet. He was 5 years older, and he was an engineer. So they fell in love, and they got married when Candy was 20.
Now, meanwhile, Betty Gore, was popular and pretty throughout her youth. When she was a teenager, she had some early puberty and attracted a lot of attention with her full figure and movie star smile. Friends would always look back and say that Betty had a boyfriend, but she never seemed to be in love. She was incredibly serious and sensible. Now, all through her senior year in high school, she had a handsome boyfriend named Jimmy, and they were planning to marry at some point. But Betty was determined to go to college and become a teacher, so we're looking at a 4-year plan here. School first.
She's very sensible.
Sensible stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then Betty went on her senior class trip and met a new guy, and she ended up breaking up with Jimmy. Going off to college a free woman was a freeing experience for her, and she dated a lot of guys, but she didn't sleep around because she was a serious Christian.
Absolutely. These were just dates. Betty met Alan Gore when she was still in college. He was the teaching assistant in her calculus class, and Betty was not good at math, so he was helping her out. Alan had grown up working on a family farm. After college, he became an engineer, and they got married in 1970. They'd had sex twice before their wedding, and that was it. In 1971, Alan finished graduate school, and Betty became ill with what her doctor called a spastic stomach.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes,
right?
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
She was eventually hospitalized, and they said she was beginning to have an ulcer. As a child, Betty had no serious medical problems. The troubles started after she broke up with Jimmy and was heading off to college. Now, after that hospitalization, things seemed okay, but then Alan had to go away on a 6-week business trip. When he called her from his trip, she would cry and beg him to come home. And while he was gone, she had a one-night stand with a younger man. And when Alan got back, she confessed, and she was very sorry. So I think she'd done it just, she was so desperate for attention, perhaps?
That's the impression I get. Now, Alan was pretty hurt by this, but he eventually got over it.
I think he was quite forgiving.
I do, too.
Yeah.
He'd always wonder if this was a calculated act by Betty to keep him from leaving home again. Now, that's a good thought.
Now, that's a good possibility. I would believe that.
So in 1973, they moved to Plano, Texas for Alan's job. Betty did some substitute teaching. A couple months after the move, though, she began to complain of various illnesses. And by November, she had prescriptions for decongestants, antibiotics, tranquilizers, and several other drugs. Then she got pregnant. She had severe morning sickness, and she also had fainting spells, and became a bit on the depressed side. So she got started on antidepressants.
After Alyssa was born, Betty did feel happier, but it didn't last very long. She was accepted as a second grade teacher, and she had a hard time controlling the students. When they were distracted or noisy, she felt helpless. If they didn't finish their work on time, she held them in from recess, which to me would be counterintuitive because they're not going to get their energy out. They're just going to be worse.
I agree.
Her discipline was tougher than the other teachers. She expected perfection, and she was constantly disappointed, of course.
From second graders?
Yeah.
No kidding.
When Alan traveled for work, she started to become bitter. In the fall of 1974, she fell into a very deep depression, and she was prescribed estrogen and Valium. And for the next year, she saw that doctor just about every week. Now, estrogen, Valium I could see to calm her down, but why would they give her estrogen?
Well, I think 40 years ago, this was looked at as kind of female problems.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So the estrogen is to kind of balance her hormone level.
Right. But there's probably no documentation that she had a hormonal problem.
There's none.
This was just what they did, maybe?
This was the treatment method.
Yeah, because these women get the vapors.
Right.
So let's give her some hormones and Valium. Maybe her husband can get some peace. That was probably the doctor's attitude.
I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't the attitude. I mean, that's probably a pervading thought back in those days.
Yeah. In 1975, Betty was rejected for a permanent position at the school. And to make it worse, she'd been replaced with someone just out of college who was bubbly and everybody loved. She couldn't deal with Alan's traveling for work. So he asked to be transferred to a position that would allow him to work only in Dallas. By 1977, Candy was bored. Now, nothing was really wrong with her marriage. Pat was providing everything she and the children needed. He had a great job at Texas Instruments. They had their dream house, and the kids were healthy, and she did love them. They had a church and a school where they had friends and felt like they belonged. But she just knew she wanted more. One thing was that Pat worked too much. Their sex life wasn't what it had been. And she sometimes felt like a laborer around the house, doing all the cooking and cleaning and watching the kids. And it wasn't that rewarding. She'd started to think she'd really missed out on things by not going to college and getting married so young. She'd gone right from being a child to being a mother. So that's when she started doing volunteer work. She took these creative writing courses, too. Now, she knew Betty from church, and for a while they were friendly, but they were very different women. Betty was seen as very uptight, and she could be kind of cold. The other women would confide in each other, but they were on their most proper behavior when Betty was around because she was easily offended.
Yeah, and she was equally awkward around kids. So everybody was surprised when she became a foster parent.
Well, she keeps doing these things like becoming a mother, a teacher, and becoming a foster parent when she really wasn't that great with kids.
Right.
I guess she wanted to be.
She was hoping to be, I guess.
I guess.
So she and Alan took in a 6-year-old boy, but she did not do well with that. He was with them for 2 weeks, and after he left, Betty told the Department of Human Services that she would prefer to care for younger children. And their next foster child was a 3-year-old girl who they had for several months. Then the church started a couples volleyball league. Candy joined in, even though Pat didn't. And at the same time, the Gores took in an 8-year-old boy as foster parents. Now, Betty had repeated clashes with this poor kid.
Yes. Now, this kid had been abused and moved from his home and then gone from foster home to foster home. He would disobey Betty's orders, and she just couldn't deal with it. She wanted perfection. So in this kind of passive-aggressive move against a child, she started to ignore him. Alan tried to talk to her and tell her that he was a good boy and he just needed some love and patience. But she really believed he was a bad kid. She called the state and demanded that they take him back. So that was the end of her foster parenting. I don't think she was meant for that.
It doesn't sound like she was.
No.
Meanwhile, back to Candy, she began to talk with her close women friends, about having an affair. She wanted sex without an emotional investment. So as we were talking about at the beginning, this just seemed like a natural extension of things, right?
I guess so.
In her thinking.
I think it's really risky to think you're going to have an affair and not get emotionally invested.
I think so.
Yeah.
Now, Candy looked at it as not interfering with her marriage, and Pat would never know.
Yeah, that's naive.
It is.
It was on the church volleyball court that Candy decided she would have sex with Alan Gore. She collided with him, and she said he smelled sexy. She told her best friend, Sherry, maybe this was the man who would give her the exciting sex she wanted. He didn't look like an exciting guy, but he had a sense of humor, and they had quite a bit in common. So they began to pay more attention to each other and got kind of flirty. They would joke back and forth, and once in a while he'd give her a kind of a wink.
You know, this just doesn't seem like a real great idea. I'm not sure, like you said, that an affair was the way to go anyway.
Yeah.
And why would you have an affair with an acquaintance?
Well, I guess she's thinking that he's married too, and he's not going to want to get involved more than just the sex, and he smelled good.
Well, that does it, right?
Well, I mean, the pheromones are important.
One night after choir practice, Candy climbed into the passenger seat of Alan's car. She told Alan that she was attracted to him, and she was tired thinking about it, so she wanted to tell him. Now, Alan, of course, was a little shocked, but he was also flattered, because Candy was one of the more attractive women in the church, and she was fun to be around. He thought about her a lot over the next few days, and they began talking about whether or not they'd have an affair.
So this whole idea of getting in the car and saying, I'm tired of thinking about it, so I just wanted to tell you, that's not the reason. She wants to plant the seed and see if he does anything about it.
That's right.
Yeah. So the affair began in a motel room. Candy made a picnic lunch and wore a lacy nightgown. The sex was brief and conventional. Alan was not very imaginative, but Candy was able to teach him a few things. For Alan, it was the most exciting sex he'd ever had. And Candy thought he showed promise she was going to work with it. Now, after their first encounter, Candy started renting a cheaper room at the Como Motel just off the freeway.
Yeah, the description of this place is that it's a by-the-hour room rental type of thing.
Yes.
So, very,
so it's very
conducive to romance.
Right. Well, they're not looking for romance. They're looking for illicit sex.
Well, I guess that's why they picked the Como.
Yep. Now, Alan would just come over and meet her during his lunch break. The sleaziness of the room made it more illicit, and they liked it. So they met there every 2 weeks on a Tuesday or a Thursday.
Yeah, and this went on for a while. Now, in 1979, Betty became pregnant again. And with this pregnancy, her health complaints escalated. At the same time, Candy began having second thoughts about her affair with Alan. He just wasn't getting any better at the sex act. And she was concerned that she was beginning to feel emotionally attached to him. She was looking forward to his companionship more than to the sex. And they had started exchanging greeting cards, and it was turning out that he was her best friend.
So she's falling in love with him.
Yeah. So despite the promise that we're not going to get emotionally attached.
Sure.
It just doesn't work that way, does it?
It surprises no one.
No.
Now, Candy told her friend Jackie that she was afraid she was falling in love with Alan. But Alan, he really didn't feel the same way. He didn't think he'd ever fall in love with Candy. But he did feel like he needed her in his life. He did love his wife, Betty, and believed that their marriage was forever. Candy hosted a baby shower for Betty at the church, and that was just 2 weeks before the baby was due.
Yeah, and this was something that really touched Betty. There's a long scene in the book about it.
About the shower?
About the shower and how she felt about the thoughtfulness of Candy for doing the shower and setting it up and everything.
Yeah, because she really wasn't that popular with the other women.
No, she wasn't.
And she was depressed, so I'm sure it meant something to her.
Absolutely.
She never dealt well with pregnancy.
No. Now, baby Bethany Gore was born in July 1979. For a while, Betty and Alan became closer, and Alan didn't see Candy for a few weeks. When he did see her again, they met at the Como, the usual place. Now that night, Betty wanted to have sex with Alan, but he couldn't because he'd been sexually involved with Candy that day.
Yeah, he'd had sex with Candy at the hotel at lunch that day.
And he just couldn't do it.
But the thing was that Betty and Alan hadn't had sex since the baby was born, so that had been a while. And Betty was really hurt when he turned her down.
Yeah.
She approached him. It wasn't something she did very often.
No, she initiated sex, and
yeah,
he just couldn't do it.
Right. So this made Alan start to feel guilty about the affair, because it was starting to affect his marriage.
It seems to be.
Yeah.
And Betty, who was kind of fragile anyway, took this as a real rejection.
Oh, sure. She was very fragile. So Alan told Candy he wouldn't be able to see her as much. And Candy was upset, and she asked if they could meet just one more time. Candy told Alan that she was in love with him. And Alan told her that Betty wanted to attend the church's marriage encounter program, so he was going to give that a try.
Yeah, this is an interesting program.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that experience.
So this marriage encounter is part of the church. It's a Methodist church, correct?
It's an extension, yes.
Right. So it's a total immersion experience that was held at a motor coach inn that was a make-believe medieval castle with dark purple furnishings.
So So I'd love to see this place.
So I wonder if that was intentional for the encounter.
I think they thought that was romantic.
So the program was run by couples who had completed the encounter. Couples were not allowed to watch TV in their rooms. Reading material was not allowed. It was all about communication and feelings. The leaders would ask a question and then the couple would go to their rooms and write down their answers. Then they exchanged notebooks with a kiss. They would discuss these answers and then everyone would meet again for another question. So Alan and Betty began to feel closer. They wrote love letters and came out of their room holding each other or holding hands.
So it was kind of working, at least for the time being. Alan met Candy, though, at the Como a week after that, and he told her all about the marriage encounter. He'd actually lost his desire to have sex with Candy at that point and told her he wanted to devote his attention to his marriage and family. So this hurt Candy, but she agreed that they should stop meeting, and she said she would miss him.
But the affair is over. So after the breakup, Candy began going to a club in Dallas called the Currency Club with her friend Sherry. They'd have a few drinks, flirt with the men, apparently innocent, not picking anybody up. Now, at a Halloween party, that was a work party, wasn't it?
I think so.
She was there with Pat, and she met a man named Richard, who she'd seen at local parties before. He was about 40 years old, had a mustache and blonde hair. They flirted, and he asked Candy for her phone number, which she provided, and they began having sex. Now, Richard had keys to a friend's apartment where they could meet. Richard was more romantic than Alan, but he would get upset if Candy couldn't see him. So she realized fairly quickly that this was not the guy she wanted to have an extramarital affair with.
No, because it would have definitely broken up her marriage or caused problems, because this guy wanted to actually be with her, it seems like.
Right. So she ended the affair, and Richard was hurt and angry. He tried to pursue her further, but her mind was made up. She was done.
Yep, she was done. Now, Pat found a love letter from Alan in Candy's closet, so that's how Pat found out about that affair. And he was quite upset, but he was also very forgiving. He decided that he had neglected her and that he needed to be a better husband, and he forgave her. Now, it had been over for a long time, and things were good in their marriage.
So he's feeling in a forgiving mood.
Well, I don't know if it's just a mood. He seems super forgiving. And Alan was forgiving with his wife, too. I think these are kind of laid-back men, like almost passive men.
It sounds like, doesn't it?
Not criticizing the forgiveness part, but they seem quite passive. So why don't we go back to January 13th, 1980, where Candy's going out with her family.
Right, we're going to the movies. So they go to see The Empire Strikes Back. Then the Montgomery family, with Alyssa, went to eat at Taco Delight, and they got home by 8 o'clock. The phone was ringing. Candy picked it up, and it was Alan. So Alan's getting kind of nervous. He says, "Have you seen Betty?" He'd been trying to reach her since before he got on the plane at 4 o'clock. He was in St. Paul, Minnesota, and was worried because he knew that Betty couldn't stand being alone, even for one night. The other thing was that she was 2 weeks late for her period, and she was terrified of going through another pregnancy. So as he had been packing for the trip the night before, Betty was complaining that he was leaving her with too much responsibility. And she cried before he left for work that morning.
So by 7:45 p.m., Alan and two other colleagues had checked into their hotel. Alan tried to call home again. And then he remembered that Alyssa had that swimming lesson at 2, so he thought they should have been home by 3:30. I mean, Betty did not go out. She didn't leave the house in the evening, and she wouldn't go out shopping with the baby. He called his neighbor then, Richard Parker, and asked if he would mind running over and knocking on the door because maybe something was wrong with the phone. And this just wasn't normal. So Richard, he wasn't that friendly with Alan, but he decided he'd run over. The Gores weren't the most social people, so he didn't know them that well. But he knocked on the door and rang the doorbell and no one answered. So he called Alan back and told him, well, she must be out. Nobody's answering. But Alan knew that this just wasn't like her, so he's getting more worried. Now, he knew that Candy had been watching Alyssa the night before and taking her to Bible school, so he called her house. And Candy said she'd seen Betty that morning when she went over to get Alyssa's bathing suit, but Alyssa was still with her. And she said, well, you know, Betty seemed fine this morning. There was nothing unusual.
And Candy put Alyssa on the phone, and Alan asked his daughter about her swimming lesson and if her mother had said anything that morning about going out. Alyssa said no, she hadn't. So Candy gets back on the phone and offered to go over and check on Betty. But Alan said he'd call back his neighbors, so he calls Richard back again. It's now like 10 o'clock.
It's getting late.
And he asked Richard to look in the garage and see if Betty's car was there. Richard ran over and peered through the window over his fence, came back to the phone and said her car was gone.
Now, he didn't look very good.
No, because it wasn't gone.
Right. He was just kind of trying to get Alan off his back.
Yep. Alan called the hospital and the police. Betty wasn't at the hospital. Then he called Candy back and asked if she'd heard from Betty. He's getting more and more worried. He called Richard a third time, asked him to check all the doors and garage again. Maybe she'd left a note somewhere. So Richard went back over and was surprised to see that Betty's car actually was there. He just hadn't seen it the last time. Well, he didn't look that carefully.
Right, but there were lights on in the house, and the doors seemed to all be locked. He came back to the phone and told Alan, well, nobody's answering. Now, Alan told Richard that he really needed to get in that house any way he could. Something was definitely wrong. After he hung up, he called his neighbor across the street, who he trusted more, Jerry McMahon, and told him what was going on. Jerry agreed that he would run over to the house. Then he couldn't get in, and he was afraid to break in alone, because now he's starting to think something might be wrong in there. So Jerry calls another friend, and Jerry, Richard, and the other friend meet outside the Gore house. And it turns out, after all that the front door was unlocked, and they just hadn't figured that out before.
Yeah, they just hadn't tried it or something.
Too obvious a thing, I guess.
Yeah.
So after they entered, they heard the exhausted wailing of a baby. Bethany was in her crib, her face red and blotchy, and her body soiled with her own dirty diaper. She'd obviously been there for a long time. Richard picked up the baby and took her next door to his wife. And he told her to call the police because something's wrong. Then he grabbed his handgun and went back. Lester, the third guy, looked in the utility room, and he's the one that saw Betty. She was obviously dead. The floor was covered in congealed brownish-red blood. She'd been dead for a while. So his first instinct was to just shut that door. It was a horrible scene.
It was horrible. There's blood all over the place.
Yeah.
Just
massacre.
Horrific scene.
Yes. Now, Jerry, he knew that Betty was a depressed person, so he thought that she had shot herself. Jerry called Alan and told him that the baby was okay, but he told him that Betty had been shot. Now, Alan called Candy again at 11:30 and told her that Betty had killed herself and asked if she would keep Alyssa until he could get back into town and get her. And she said, sure, no problem. She tried to be quite helpful.
She was. Now, this utility room where they found Betty was maybe 6 feet wide by 12 feet long.
Yeah, plus it had a freezer in it and a washer and dryer.
Yeah, a lot of
stuff.
It wasn't
very big.
No, it was crowded. Blood was dark, almost black. Betty was found lying face up in a yellow blood-saturated top with gaping wounds all over her body. Her left arm was extended out near the door, and that was in a pool of blood so thick that it seemed to float over the linoleum. Her elbow was cut so deeply that it was nearly severed. Her left eye was wide open, but her right eye wasn't there. The entire right side of her face had been obliterated. Then a few feet from her head and under the freezer, there was a 3-foot wooden-handled axe. So this is a particularly gruesome crime. So it sounds like Betty was hacked to death with an axe.
Crime scene investigators worked until dawn, going through the Gore house inch by inch. At 6:30 a.m., they found a bloody fingernail. It was a woman's nail, but they really didn't think it was Betty's. They took numerous blood samples, a clump of hair from the bathtub drain, and they got a photo of the bloody fingerprint. And there were several bloody footprints, and there was the axe. So this was a really unusual case in many ways. The axe was an odd weapon, and the victim was a white middle-class woman. Betty's body had numerous wounds from over 40 blows with an axe. Her right arm had 5 cuts that were very deep. Her left arm had more serious wounds that ran horizontally. But the center of the killer's rage had definitely been her head. Half of her face was just a mass of tissue. The eye socket and cheekbone had been chopped into small pieces. That damage had been caused by 6 blows after Betty had already been on the floor and was not moving.
Yeah, the fatal wound was when it had penetrated her skull and gone deep into her brain, pushing a portion of her brain out onto the floor.
Wow. There,
yeah. There are also three deep gouges in the back of Betty's skull. Two of these wounds were pointed at the top but squared off at the bottom. The coroner felt that the only explanation for this finding was that the axe had been swung with such force that it got stuck in her skull.
Wow.
And the killer had to wiggle it back and forth to free it, like when you're chopping wood.
Yeah, that's brutal. And why wouldn't you just stop at that point? It had to be someone in a rage.
This was a rage killing. Most of the wounds were inflicted while Betty was still alive. And when they did the autopsy, she had not been pregnant.
Candy only slept for a couple of hours that night. She and Pat had stayed up late talking, and after Pat had gone to sleep, she kept thinking of that last time she talked to Alan. He told her that he had mentioned to the police that she'd been at the house and seen Betty that morning, so he said they'll probably be calling you. So she got up early and made breakfast for the kids, and they went out to play in the lawn sprinkler. Word was getting around town about the murder, and some church members were calling Candy to ask if she had heard. On the radio, it was announced that Betty was killed with an axe, and the police found bloody footprints all over the house. Candy went into the bathroom to change the Band-Aid on her toe, and Pat walked in from doing the yard work. She told him that she'd cut her toe on the damn metal storm door that Pat had been meaning to fix. Now, after Pat went back outside, Candy chopped up her rubber sandals with a pair of garden shears. When they were nothing more than a pile of rubber, she put the scraps into an outside garbage bin.
Because those were the sandals she'd been wearing when this all happened.
Yes.
And they were sandal footprints. At this point, she's trying to hide that fact. So Alan hears that Betty had been killed with an axe, and he nearly collapses. He felt guilty for not being there. Now, he had called Candy when he got back to town and asked her to keep Alyssa for a few more hours. And Alyssa had no idea that her mother was dead.
No, she's still playing with the kids at the Montgomery house.
Yeah, she's having a good time with Jenny and the Montgomerys.
Yep.
So at 3:30, Alan called Candy and asked her to bring Alyssa home. She dropped her children with a neighbor, and Pat went with her. So this is kind of unusual. They're driving Alyssa back by herself with Pat and Candy. And yeah. Alyssa just knew something was wrong.
Yeah, because that's not the way it was usually done.
No.
Now, once at the Gore house, Alan hugged Alyssa and gave Candy a brief hug, too. Candy couldn't look him in the eye. She and Pat turned to leave, but Alan asked them to stay. Candy noticed that the utility room door was closed. Alan sat down on the sofa, put his arm around Alyssa, and told her that her mommy had been hurt and she wouldn't be coming back. Now, listening to this, Candy began to cry. She stood up, walked over, and wrapped her arms around Alan and Alyssa, and the three of them cried for a few minutes together, kind of huddled up. That night before bed, Pat noticed that Candy's legs were covered with purple bruises, and she told him she got them from doing housework and bumping into the dishwasher. But this kind of raised his... maybe not suspicions, but it piqued his interest.
It certainly did.
Yeah.
Because this is an unusual occurrence.
The bruises. Yeah. So I think this is the first little drop of him beginning to question her.
It is.
Yeah.
That's for sure. So there's a guy named Don Crowder, who is a member of the church, and he's the church's lawyer. After the Sunday service, Don talked with other people about Betty's murder. Now, he was not a criminal lawyer, but he speculated that Betty's killer was a sex criminal or a robber, probably a drifter who was hundreds of miles away by then.
He couldn't have been more wrong. So as he's talking about that, he's approached by Candy, and she asks to talk with him alone. When they're alone, she told him that she was at the Gore house Friday morning and may have been the last person to see Betty. She was supposed to meet with the police that afternoon, and she wanted his advice. Don told her not to worry, this is just routine. And, of course, you're not a suspect. Of course not, little lady.
Yeah, that's right. Don't you worry.
Yeah.
Don't you worry your pretty little head about
that's
that.
That's about how it was, yeah. So Candy dressed in a blouse, skirt, and heels for her meeting at the police station that afternoon and drove herself there, even though Pat offered to come with her. Chief Abbott had invited the Collin County Sheriff's investigator, Steve Deffenbaugh, to help him with the interview. Candy told them that she'd picked up Alyssa that Thursday and she'd spent the night with them. She hadn't known that Alan was going out of town. They wanted her to give them a rundown of her day that Friday. And she appeared relaxed as she explained everything from vacation Bible school to the late night call from Alan. Nothing in her day seemed out of the ordinary. She'd taken the kids to Bible school, left the church around 9:45, arrived at Betty's house around 10. Betty'd been drinking coffee and sewing. She'd put the sewing aside so they could chat, and then the two went outside to play with the Gore's two dogs. Now, at one point, Candy said she did go into the bathroom to pick her hair. So, for those youngsters out there, when you had those 70s hairdos, the little afros, you couldn't brush through them, you had a little pick.
That's right.
Where you kind of pick it to fluff it back up, and that's what she did. And that was very popular in the late 70s, early 80s.
It certainly was.
Near the end of the visit, Candy had gone into the utility room, too. She said that's where she went to get Alyssa's bathing suit. And this entire visit, according to Candy, was only about 15 minutes.
So they also asked Candy what she'd been wearing that day. Now, she said she was wearing a burgundy top and jeans with blue tennis shoes. Now, she must have forgotten that she was wearing her sandals.
Forgotten?
Maybe. She said that she could bring the shoes to them. Then she went on to tell them that she went to a Target store to buy Father's Day cards, but once she got there, she looked at her watch and realized it had stopped. Her watch said 10:15. So she asked someone in the parking lot for the time and found out it was 11:10. So she was pretty late. She drove straight back to the vacation Bible school. Got there at 11:30 for the luncheon. Later, she took the kids to Walmart, drove Alyssa to her swim lesson, and then the whole family went to the movies.
Before she left the police station, Deffenbaugh asked Candy if she'd be willing to undergo hypnosis to find out if there was anything about that day that she just couldn't remember. And Candy agreed, and then she returned home and she felt better, like, oh, I'm glad that's over with. Now I can put this whole mess behind me.
Yeah, the tone of the book was that Candy was relieved that it didn't look like she was going to be a suspect.
Oh, yeah, I think the book and the movie gave that impression.
Yeah. Now, Betty's parents are Bertha and Bob Pomeroy, and they were devastated to hear that their daughter was dead. And when they learned that Betty had been brutally murdered with an axe, they are even more stunned. They arrived at the house on Sunday afternoon. Several women from the church were there, and they all tried to console Bertha. Bob was disturbed by Bethany's behavior. She had always been an outgoing, happy baby, but now she was shy and nervous. Well, this poor little infant, she's what, 1 year old?
Yeah.
She'd been in a crib all day?
Yes.
Nobody tending to her?
Well, we don't know if she was in the crib the whole time. She may have witnessed things.
True.
Because we'll never know the true whole story.
Now, Bob knew that she'd been traumatized by being left alone all day, but he wondered if there had been more to it than they knew.
Yeah, and I wonder that also. Alan found Candy's presence to be very comforting. He knew that women from the church would be bringing food, and he called her to make sure that she would be there. Candy stayed a while because Alan asked her to. Bertha, Betty's mom, found Candy to be very comforting. She was at ease around them, and she took care of dirty dishes and did other little chores around the house without being asked. Police started to believe that Betty had been killed by someone she knew, though. Now, Alan, the husband, was the first suspect.
Well, of course.
It seemed coincidental that he was out of town on the day his wife was killed. But his alibi did check out. He was in St. Paul. He'd been with co-workers the entire time. Now, of course, that doesn't mean he couldn't have been involved at all just because he wasn't there. So he's still a suspect. Everyone said that he showed genuine grief, though, when he heard about Betty's death. So officers talked to Alan several times, and he described his day for them in detail. When he was asked if he'd ever had an affair, though, he denied it. And then after returning home, that kept going through his head, and he regretted that he'd told that lie. So he called the police back, and he told them that he did have an affair with Candy Montgomery.
Uh-huh.
Although it was over.
It was over. Right, so Alan was asked to come back and be re-interviewed. Well, sure. He was composed and unemotional as he gave the detectives his version of the affair. Now, Betty had never shown any sign of suspecting the affair, but Alan wasn't sure she would have told him if she had. Alan said that he had called back after the last interview because his daughter Alyssa had told him that Candy had been gone from vacation Bible school from about 9 o'clock till noon. So Alan felt that that was too long a time for her to have been away.
And that's not the times that she gave the police either.
Right.
I think she said 9:45 to 11:30.
Yeah.
So she was trying to make it sound like she wasn't gone that long.
So the doctors at the Dallas Institute of Forensic Sciences went over Betty's autopsy photos with a magnifying glass. Half the fingernail was missing from the second finger of her left hand, but the nail that was found at the scene was much smaller. So they think that is probably the murderer's fingernail.
Yes, now they're starting to think maybe a woman killed her.
Yep. So this wasn't as big a deal as it would be today, because this was before routine DNA testing.
Yeah, so they really can't prove it's her nail.
Right. But the most important piece of evidence was the bloody fingerprint that was found on the freezer. So they wanted a confession from Candy, and they wanted her fingerprints to confirm that she had been the killer.
Yeah, so it was Wednesday when she got a call from Chief Abbott. He said, oh, I just have a couple more questions, and she agreed to come by that morning. But Abbott was actually having a lot more serious thoughts about her than he would let on. He called in Texas Ranger Fred Cummings to come and take Candy's fingerprints. Now, Abbott explained that they needed the fingerprints of all family and friends who'd been in the house, so this was just routine. After they got her fingerprints, then they began the interview. Candy was asked to repeat the events of that Friday. She told the same story, but she added more details. She admitted to the affair with Alan Gore and said it had been over for, I think it was 8 months. While she was talking, Cummings came in with the fingernail and put it on Abbott's desk. And to catch her off guard, the detective said just flat out, "You murdered Betty Gore, didn't you?" But Candy reacted very calmly, and she was cool. She said, "No, I didn't." She surprised the interviewers by how calm she was. She said, "I didn't murder her." And they wondered, why isn't this woman in hysterics like most people would be?
No kidding.
But Candy was very stoic. She was confronted with the bloody fingerprint, which matched hers. Then they examined her car and took her shoes. She agreed to return the next day to take a polygraph exam.
All right, so Candy goes home and tells Pat that she's a suspect.
Yeah, when she gets home, she's kind of freaking out. She's showing more how she feels.
She sure is. So Pat called Don Crowder, the church member who's the lawyer.
Right.
They met Don at his office that day. Now, Candy still seemed like her normal, energetic, and bubbly self. So Pat wrote a check to ensure attorney-client privilege. Don asked Pat to leave the room. Candy told Don the whole story of the affair and her police interviews. Now, Don felt like the police were being pretty overzealous in their pursuit of Candy. And he told her he wasn't going to allow her to take the polygraph test. He also wanted Candy to call the women who were at the church on the day of the murder and ask them if they remembered what she was wearing. If she was wearing the same outfit before and after she left, it would help her case.
Right, because her clothes would have been blood-covered if she was the killer and wearing the same clothing. Now, Candy returned to Crowder's office the next day. He had a young associate, Rob Udashin, who had criminal experience, and he was helping with the case. After talking with Candy for a while, Rob realized that things were much more serious than he and Crowder had initially thought. Candy seemed so cool and detached, as she told Rob that the police had matched her fingerprint and shoe size with the crime scene. They had accused her of killing Betty, and she was discussing it as if they were planning a church dinner.
Yeah, she was still pretty calm and collected.
Yes, at least on the outside. I'm sure on the inside she was freaking out.
I think so. Don arranged for a private polygraph in his office, because there was still an hour and alibi that was missing. Now, Don thought that Candy may have been covering for Alan. However, after an hour, Candy confessed to Don that she was, in fact, the murderer of Betty Gore.
Yeah. Now, Betty's murder, of course, was big news. It became a bigger story on June 19th when the Dallas News Media announced that the police had a suspect. And the suspect was a woman who had had an affair with the victim's husband. So this has all the aspects of a media frenzy.
Doesn't it?
Yes. As the media closed in on the Montgomery home, Don told Candy she needed to get away for a while. So the family went to stay with Candy's friend Sherry. Candy had not confessed to Pat, and he was confused about what was happening. The papers said that they had a bloody fingerprint that proved Candy did it. And when he asked Candy about it, she said, "Well, the lawyer told me not to talk about it." but this is her husband.
Right. You'd think he could talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Rob called police and asked if they would call him before they placed Candy under arrest because they saw that coming and they wanted to avoid a media circus. But the police wouldn't make that promise. As soon as they had their warrant, they said they were coming for her. Alan Gore was brought in to take a polygraph to make sure he wasn't involved, and he passed the test. On Friday the 20th, Candy's attorneys took her to the hospital for a physical exam. Bruises were noted on her legs and on her chest. He described the cut on her forehead, which had scabbed over. She was very anxious, and she was prescribed Cerax and Valium. Now, what's Cerax? I know Valium is...
Cerax is just an old-time antidepressant.
Okay, so these are psych meds.
Mood stabilizer type thing, yeah.
Okay. Then Candy was taken to her appointment with a polygraph examiner who'd been hired by Don Crowder. When she got back home, she didn't tell Pat about her physical exam, and she told him she couldn't talk about the polygraph. Pat had no idea that Candy had anything to do with the murder, but he's starting to get a funny feeling, and he's confused. Then he began to feel kind of paranoid, like the police were maybe framing her, and he couldn't understand why. I mean, Candy was a good person. Why are they after his nice, homemaking, church-loving wife?
He just couldn't see that.
No, not at all.
So when she was arrested, the bondsmen required the deed to their house and a $90,000 promissory note. Candy was strip-searched, photographed, and examined by a doctor. She spent the night in jail and was taken for her preliminary hearing the next day, and that time she pled not guilty. So Don Crowder thought that Candy did look like a murderer with a frizzy hairdo and emotionless expression. So he told her to let her hair grow out and to try to show some emotion. Now, meanwhile, no one at the church believed that Candy was capable of this crime. Don asked them to tell any reporters that approached him that Candy was a good person. He wanted the police to look like villains to the public.
So this John Crowder is a clever guy. I mean, I'm really impressed with him as we go through the story.
Oh, well, I'll say.
A civil attorney, he really performed well. Candy became very aloof and nervous, and she did maintain her composure. She decided to let the lawyers and God handle things, so she was going to let go and let God. Pat was becoming very suspicious, though. He'd noticed that the shoes were missing, the rubber sandals. So Candy had destroyed them, but she just told him she'd toss them out without saying why she did that. She refused to discuss the case with him, too, claiming that Don told her not to talk to anyone. But Pat thought, that doesn't include me, her husband. Now, Pat's a super honest person, and he asked a friend from the church, well, should I go to the police and tell them about the shoes? He also brought up the bruises and the cuts on her toe and forehead with the friend. Now, he said he would love her no matter what, but he didn't want her to get away with murder. Don Crowder had possession of the clothes Candy had been wearing on the day of the murder. For several days, the three attorneys from Don's practice were passing the clothing back and forth between their homes and their cars. So they were doing this so the police wouldn't find them?
Yeah, just playing musical chairs with the clothing so that the police couldn't track them down.
Well, after the Montgomery home had been thoroughly searched, Don did give the bag of clothing to Pat, and Pat put the bag in a closet.
Right. Then in early July, Dallas newspapers reported that blood had been found in Candy's station wagon, and two other sources that also confirmed that Candy had confessed to her attorney after failing a private polygraph exam.
So there's a leak.
Someone's leaking.
Yeah.
Because this is pretty true, right?
It is.
The sources said that Candy murdered Betty sometime on the morning of June 13th after getting into an argument about an affair that she had had with Betty's husband. So Crowder filed a motion for a change of venue, saying that Candy could not get a fair trial in Collin County. He was hoping for Galveston or Port Arthur, where killings just happen more often.
Yeah, so are these people just more laid back and they'll let her get away with that? I don't know what the thought is there.
So at the venue hearing, the defense had witnesses to back up that people had preconceived opinions on the case. Now, Don flew with Candy to Houston to be examined by psychiatrist Dr. Faison. He met with her for hours. He hypnotized her and said he found the source of her rage. Don Crowder asked if Faison could put Candy under again and plant a trigger phrase that would cause her to show emotion when he put her on the stand.
This is kind of brilliant.
It is, isn't it?
I would never think of it, but it is kind of brilliant.
So there are many more interviews required to sort out the details of Candy's childhood trauma, as well as the terrible and fatal struggle between Candy and Betty. But by the end of the first session, Faison had done what Crowder had asked him to do. He had found the trigger of Candy Montgomery's rage.
So this had something to do with being injured and people telling her to be quiet or saying, shh,
shh.
Right. So that was supposed to trigger the rage that made her kill Betty.
Yes.
By October 1980, Crowder was ready for the trial. He stunned everyone with the declaration that his client would plead self-defense. Which is really radical when you pummel someone 41 times with an axe.
This is a bold move.
It sure is.
He's going to put her on the stand.
Yep.
Wow.
When Candy was called as a witness, seats in the court were in high demand. People wanted to see this. This was like a show. Candy appeared in court looking sober and matronly. Crowder had told her what to wear. Her hair was still short, but it was more wavy than frizzy. She wore some nice earrings and a loose-fitting blue dress that fell way below her knees. Over her shoulders, she wore a white cotton sweater. In spite of Crowder's coaching, though, Candy was not a model witness. Her voice was very clipped, and she came across as cold. As Crowder questioned her about her children, her upbringing, her community and church activities, and her friendship with the Gores, Candy gave short, only factual answers. There was no emotion in her voice. Her story didn't come spontaneously. 2 months before the trial, Candy had repeated the events of the 13th to Crowder. And whenever her conscious story conflicted with her unconscious story, Crowder confronted her with the lie and forced her to admit the facts that she would rather have forgotten. Now, from those sessions, Crowder got the best possible reconstruction of the killing of Betty Gore, where Candy looked like she had just lost control in self-defense.
Right. So his recreation or reconstruction of the crime was that Betty responded to Candy's knock on the door, and she was looking annoyed. She'd probably just sat down to rest for the first time that day after putting Bethany into her crib for her nap. She had probably hurried to the door so the noise wouldn't wake the baby. She had a half-finished cup of coffee, and the Phil Donahue show was on TV. Betty had no plans to go out that day. She was wearing old, tight-fitting red denim shorts, a yellow short-sleeved pullover, and sandals. Now, Candy was abrupt, but was friendly and smiling. She told Betty that both girls wanted Alyssa to see the movie with them that night. She told them that if it was okay with Betty, it was okay with her, and she said she'd be happy to take Alyssa to her swim lessons. So Betty said that'd be okay. She invited Candy inside. Two women walked into the living room, where Betty switched off the television, and they went into the kitchen. Candy sat next to the sewing machine, where she noticed that Betty was making something out of yellow cloth. So Betty came back and sat on the other side of the small table. She seemed fairly tense, as though she were anxious for Candy to leave.
Yeah, Betty did seem to be loosening up a little, she said, as they made some small talk. They chatted for a while, then Candy looked at her watch. She asked for Alyssa's suit. Betty didn't move, and her face was blank. And she said, "Candy, are you having an affair with my husband, Alan?" And this stunned Candy. She didn't expect that. It's been over for a while. She thought it was behind her. But she denied it at first. She said, "Of course not." But Betty became angry and said, "But you did, didn't you?" So Candy said yes, but she said that was a long time ago. And she couldn't really look at Betty's face. This is embarrassing, right? But Betty said nothing and was just staring straight ahead. So Betty, out of nowhere, says, "Wait a minute," and gets up and walks through the door to the utility room, and she's out of sight. So Candy wonders where she went. And she also wonders, how did Betty find out about this?
Well, sure. So a few seconds go by, and Betty reappears in the doorway. She's got this stern look on her face, and she's holding a curved wooden handle of a 3-foot axe. You know, the kind used for chopping firewood. Now, her stance wasn't threatening because she was holding the axe clumsily away from her body and the blade is pointed to the floor. Candy was more worried about what Betty would say more than she was worried about what she would do. Candy stood up but didn't move from her chair. So Betty says, "Don't see him again," as an order. So under the circumstances, Candy said, "I think I'll just bring Alyssa home and drop her off right after Bible school."
That seems to make sense.
That's a good idea, isn't it?
I thought so. But Betty wasn't having it. She said she didn't want to see Candy ever again and to just keep Alyssa and take her to the movie and bring her home tomorrow. Now Betty laid the X against a wall inside the living room and walked past Candy into the middle of the room. She said, "I'll go get a towel for Alyssa," and then over her shoulder she told Candy to get the bathing suit from the utility room. Now at that point, according to Candy, she just wanted to get out of the house as soon as possible. And as she took the swimsuit off the washer, Betty reappeared behind her. So these two women are in this tiny utility room, and Betty handed the towel to Candy. She was staring at Candy, but her expression wasn't angry anymore, but she looked really sad. And Candy was thinking about how Betty was going to cry after she left, and she was feeling guilty. So both women are just standing there, and then Candy said she put her hand on Betty's arm and said, "Oh, Betty, I'm so sorry." But this kind of backfired and enraged Betty to have her show pity toward her. She flung Candy's hand from her arm and shoved Candy backward into the utility room. She grabbed the axe that was resting by the door and rushed in after her, holding it like a weapon, diagonally across her chest. So the blade was still pointed at the floor, and Betty screamed, "You can't have him." So Candy's feeling kind of backed into a corner. And I think that she said Betty told her that she was also going to have a baby and that Candy should just stay away from him. So I think Candy probably made another mistake when she said she didn't want Alan. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, "Alan doesn't want me, he loves you," or something more positive.
Right.
So now she's saying she doesn't want Alan. And now she grabs a hold of the axe, and they're both holding the axe, kind of pushing back and forth. Betty began to jerk it, trying to control it. And Candy said she was begging her to stop, and that Betty said, "I've got to kill you."
So they're both fighting for control of the axe. Then Betty pulled the axe violently and jerked it upward. Flat side of the blade slapped against the side of Candy's head. Candy stepped back further into the utility room, grabbed her head with her hand. She looked at her hand, and it was streaked with blood. So this is the hairline gash.
Right. Now, what do you think of this whole idea that's been... Some people have proposed this idea that when people see blood, it can just kind of further this kind of rage.
Well, you hear that. I'm not sure how true it is.
I know. I mean, you hear that with a wild animal.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's true. Kind of that people can get into a frenzy from the sight of blood.
Right.
I've never felt that way, but
no, I just
it's
feel
interesting.
Faint.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, Candy's been kind of wounded. She looks back at Betty and sees Betty raising the axe blade above her head, almost to the 8-foot ceiling. So Candy screamed at the top of her lungs, jumped sideways onto a cabinet, spilling books and knickknacks onto the floor. So even though she had no place to hide, because Betty was between Candy and the doorway, the axe missed her entirely, landed on the linoleum. The blade made a dull thud, bounced and gashed Candy's toe. As it did that, Candy grabbed the blade, wrapping her fingers around the thick, heavy metal. This time her pleading to Betty turned to anger.
Yeah, so now they're both angry.
Really angry.
Which is a bad situation with an axe between you. This exaggerated blow and the drawing of blood supposedly brought out this fury in them. And as soon as Candy grabbed the blade, Betty started shoving and jerking with the handle. But Candy held on tightly, and the struggle turned into sort of a wrestling match. Betty thrust and jabbed the axe at Candy. Candy responded by trying to jerk the handle out of Betty's hand, and I think Candy was probably stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Betty moved her hands up the handle and tried to get leverage, and then she bit Candy on the knuckle. With her head bent, Betty was off balance, and Candy shoved the axe against Betty's body with all her might, and it's at this point that Betty fell against the door of the freezer and her feet slipped. As Betty's struggling to regain her balance, with her body facing away, Candy grabbed the axe, brought it up with both hands, and brought the blade down on the back of Betty's head. So this is the point of no return.
Right. Now we've really escalated here, right?
Yeah.
So according to Candy, the blow sounded like a cork coming out of a wine bottle.
Oh.
And then there's blood gushing across the back of Betty's neck. So Candy dropped the axe, jumped away from Betty. Betty began to slump toward the floor, blood pouring out of her skull. But she continued to struggle to her feet. So terrified by the sight of the blood and the fact that she had just kind of mortally wounded her, Candy tried to run for the door, but Betty slammed her body against the door.
And I can't stress enough here that this is Candy's version.
This is Candy's version.
I mean, it could be that Betty didn't do any of this.
Right.
Now, Candy looked up and saw blood spreading across the side of Betty's face, and Betty had picked up the axe again. Candy grabbed the axe again, and they began this strange kind of dance around the room, jabbing and pushing at the axe. Betty's head was dripping blood, and the linoleum was becoming covered with it. So they're circling around and around, one losing her grip and then regaining it before she could be shoved away. And at one point, when Betty bumped against the freezer, Candy removed a hand from the axe and grabbed the knob of the door to the garage. She pulled at the door, open a few inches, but Betty managed to shove her away and slam it. She also said that Betty locked the door. They kicked each other as they tried to get a good position on each other, and their shoes were squeaking on the sticky, bloody floor. And there's this electrical hum of the washing machine, and they're grunting and breathing heavily. Betty grabbed Candy's hair with one hand, then Candy said she slipped on the blood and went down hard in front of the freezer. As she did, Betty tried to raise the axe, but she grew weak from losing blood, maybe, and couldn't get up. So Candy tackled her by one leg, and Betty was sprawling forward on top of her. Then Candy shoved Betty hard, jumped to her feet, and lunged at the garage door, but she said the knob wouldn't turn, and she turned back, and Betty was still coming at her.
She was. Now she placed her finger to her lips with one hand and held the axe with the other hand, and Betty breathed from somewhere deep in her throat. Shh.
So, according to Crowder and Candy, this is where, I don't know, what would you call it? She went into like some kind of...
This triggered her fugue state.
Yeah, I was going to say fugue, but I didn't know if that was the appropriate word.
Well, as appropriate as we can get.
Okay. So this shh was supposed to echo through Candy's subconscious, like some kind of psychic alarm, according to Crowder. She grabbed the axe and used it aggressively, pushing the handle against Betty's legs, and then Candy got the axe, leaned backward with all her might, and got both of her hands around it. The handle was covered with blood, and when Betty tried to pull just as hard, like a tug of war, her hand slipped off and she fell back. But she wouldn't stay down still. She lunged towards Candy. Candy had time to raise the axe and bring it down, so she's all full of adrenaline, and there's no pity or remorse anymore. And she just destroys Betty, right? Her rage is just unbelievable.
Keeps hacking away.
Right. And she didn't stop until she was physically exhausted. And according to the coroner, there were 41 chops. And 40 of them were given while Betty's heart was still beating. So she was alive.
Yeah, but she wasn't conscious.
Probably not. I mean, at some point she had to pass out from blood loss.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of blood coming out. Now, the courtroom's listening to this, and they're silent when she finishes her version of the killing.
I'll bet they're stunned.
Yeah.
You know?
This isn't a story you hear every day.
No.
But the thing about it was Candy's voice never rose. It was all very flat. And Crowder was continuing to question her, but she just kept being so monotone. He didn't like that. So, describing the struggle, her cheeks had trembled and she'd sobbed a little bit, but she was still maintaining her composure for the most part. So Crowder, he's afraid that her testimony seemed too rehearsed. So this is where he comes in with his trigger, right? He says, when you went over there, did you mean to kill her with that axe? And she says, no, but he has the axe there. And he puts it on his right hip and says, but you did kill her with the axe, didn't you? So he's walking toward her with the axe. And he grabs the axe with both hands, brings it into view, and thrusts it forward towards Candy. So this is real courtroom drama.
It is.
And this is where she lost her composure. She screamed. And he kept at her. You killed her with the axe right here, didn't you? So Pat, he was down the hall 30 yards away, and he could hear Candy scream in the courtroom. And then she started crying. And she did admit to killing Betty at that point, or that she wanted to kill her.
Right. This is a very dramatic scene.
I know. It seems like it would be fictional, but it was real.
Made for TV, almost.
Almost.
So one of the women jurors dabbed at her reddened eyes with a tissue, and another was squirming in her seat as though she was kind of offended by this courtroom trick.
I think I would be.
She also wondered why Candy seemed so emotionless, but she felt sympathy towards her at the same time, because her story did feel real. But she couldn't be sure. She wanted the prosecutor, Tom O'Connell, to be tough and pry open every part of her story, to find a lie in it that would make it all come apart.
And I feel like O'Connell didn't really follow through like he could have.
He didn't. So Crowder led Candy through the rest of her day and had her admit all the cover-ups and evasions of the following week as she was trying to avoid detection. So O'Connell stuck to his original plan and he tried to expose the cracks in Candy's story. He asked Candy to repeat what happened in the utility room, but with much less detail. She didn't hesitate doing this and there are no contradictions. So O'Connell's questions wandered from place to place, from the utility room to a friend's divorce, back to the cover-ups, just kind of haphazard. He emphasized that a year-old baby had been left alone by this woman who prided herself on her motherhood. He pointed out Candy's repeated lies to her friends, and then, abruptly, he stopped questioning.
So you know what's funny to me is this leaving the baby alone all day? That bothers people more than the axe murder for some people.
It seems to, doesn't it?
Yeah, people think, how could you leave that baby? So it's kind of funny how people think sometimes. Candy's testimony ended on a Friday. The following Wednesday, the jury heard the final arguments and they reached their verdict that same afternoon. It was quite quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just amazed she was found not guilty. This was stunning to just about everyone. Not guilty.
Not guilty.
So she's leaving the courthouse with her attorney and a guard, and people are screaming at her. Murderer. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you could buy the self-defense aspect of it. There's all that overkill.
Yeah.
So I have a tough time going with self-defense when there's over 40 blows.
I don't buy it at all, but I just think that Crowder is brilliant.
He did his job, didn't he?
He had the jury in the palm of his hand, apparently. Because I don't think that's a kosher decision at all. Maybe second degree murder, because maybe she hadn't been planning it. Maybe
right.
She did kind of lose her cool, but to be not guilty by self-defense, I mean, we have no evidence that Betty Gore was going after Candy at all.
Just Candy's story.
Right. There's no witnesses to that.
No. Nope.
Nobody even knows if she knew about the affair. And that's all Candy's saying. We don't know.
Yeah, so...
And Candy
had a great lawyer.
I know. And he wasn't even a criminal lawyer.
No.
It's just amazing to me. That's the most amazing part of this case for me. So Candy and Pat really couldn't hang around. She was hated. But Pat was hanging in with her.
Yeah, he did. So Candy and her husband, Pat, did relocate to somewhere in Georgia near Atlanta after the trial.
Right. But Alan Gore, he ended up marrying his neighbor, Elaine Clift, just a few months after the acquittal. Now, reportedly, this romance had started within a couple weeks of Betty's murder. So that kind of backs me up in thinking Alan had a lot of guilt and felt responsible for Betty, but he wasn't in love with her.
I don't think he liked her that much.
No, I think he was kind of relieved to have her gone.
Yeah. Well, and just what happened with his kids would suggest that too.
Yeah, they didn't forgive him. They blamed his affair. Which I can kind of see. If he hadn't had the affair, it might not have happened. So his two daughters, they didn't have a positive relationship with him at all, and they were adopted by their maternal grandparents, Betty's mom and dad, and moved to Kansas, and pretty much became estranged from him, right?
They did. No contact.
So 20 years after the killing, when Bethany was 20 and Elisa was 25, they spoke with the Dallas Morning News, and this is the last time that I know of that they've spoken with the media. And they said they felt like they would never know exactly what happened that day, but they definitely felt like Candy got away with murder. If you look at it, Candy was in love with Alan. She admitted that.
She did.
So how do we know she didn't go over there and kill Betty so she could be with Alan? It makes more sense to me than her story.
Well, it does. Yeah.
And this is like... This is up in Casey Anthony territory when it comes to getting away with killing someone.
Yeah.
It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I was just flabbergasted when I got to that part of the book and they said not guilty. I said, you got to be kidding me.
I know, right? Crazy. So Candy was still living in Georgia under her maiden name, Candace Wheeler, when the Dallas Morning News reached out to her at the same time they talked to Alan's daughters, but she had no comment. Now, much of our information for this episode came from the book Evidence of Love by John Bloom and Jim Atkinson. Of course, there's a whole lot more to the story, so if you're interested, I would read that book or listen to it on Audible.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it.
Yep. There was also a made-for-TV movie, Killing in a Small Town, and Barbara Hershey. You know who she is?
Yeah.
Yeah. She plays Candy.
Okay, good choice.
Yeah, she does a good job, so... You know, it's your typical TV movie, but it's pretty well done. It was watchable. I watched it on YouTube.
Well, I think we've discussed this enough.
Okay. Do you think I got into too much detail?
No.
Okay. All right.
But it's very interesting. Not guilty.
Yeah.
After chopping a person up, you get to be found not guilty.
Right. And this was a case that was recommended to us by a handful of people. If I knew who the first person was, I would thank them, but I don't know.
Yeah, but there were more than one.
There was more than one, so just thank you guys for suggesting it. I'd never heard of it, and it was a super interesting case.
It certainly was.
I like doing this episode. So before we sign off for the day, I'd just like to remind everyone about our Design a T-Shirt contest, a True Crime Brewery T-Shirt. We're looking for a new t-shirt design from one of our listeners, and we're offering a $250 prize. You can send your entry in to us to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com or in a message on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. What we really want is a design that shows the heart of what True Crime Brewery is, and something that's kind of simple, but not at the same time. So there's a trick to this, right?
I guess so.
Yeah.
And you're the only one that has the solution to the trick.
Because I have an image in my mind of what I want.
Okay.
And we might have it, but it might still be out there. So I would encourage anyone interested to go ahead and give it a try. So just send it along in a PNG or JPG format by February 1st, 2018. And we plan to have t-shirts made with this design for CrimeCon in the spring. Now, one thing I'm thinking is the person who designs it will get one of the t-shirts, of course. And maybe we'll have a runner-up who gets a t-shirt, too, but doesn't get the money prize.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So, also a brief update on what we're doing here at Tie Grabber. We have our members-only podcast, where we just did the Grimes sister disappearance and murder. We also have our Watching ID podcast. And this month, we're covering Village of the Damned on Investigation Discovery. It's the story of a town that is said to be cursed by many people, Dryden, New York. Between 1989 and 1999, Dryden had several murders, and this is a five-part series that we're covering in two episodes of Watching ID. The first one's been released, and you can listen to it anytime, and the next one will be released by the end of the month, as soon as all the episodes come out. So I'm looking at this as our holiday contribution to the Watching ID podcast. The TV show, if you're interested, is on Tuesday nights, and you can catch up on it if you have the ID Go app. Even if you don't, though, I always say that you could still enjoy listening to the podcast because we give a full recap. Now, over on True Crime Brewery, we are still doing our weekly episodes and additionally our members only. And Dick is always looking for more beer, so if you have a beer specific to your region that you'd like to share, let us know. We'll give you our P.O. box and you can send it along.
Or if not sending actual beer, let me know a beer that you like for that particular crime.
And then maybe you can track it down.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. If you enjoy True Crime Brewery or if you enjoy Watching ID or both, please give us a review on iTunes when you have a few minutes because that really helps us get new listeners. Watching ID is pretty new, so it has very few reviews, but it has 5 stars. So that's cool. And don't forget to give us your suggestions on our Facebook page, Twitter, or Instagram, or to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. So we're going to go right to feedback.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a case suggestion from Teddy G. Teddy says, I'd love for you to do an episode on Robert Fisher, who's still on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. This is personal. I'm a mail carrier in South Scottsdale, Arizona, and our old station was less than a mile from the Fisher's house. We were working when it blew up, and the blast rocked our building. No one has done a book that I'm aware of, but there's a lot out there. You, unlike many true crime podcasts, review cases that are solved, so this would be one I'd love to hear. Robert Fisher slit the throats of his sleeping children and wife, shot her in the head, and then rigged his house, which was very close to neighboring homes, to explode. He's still out there, and it would be nice to have some light shed on him, as he needs to be brought to justice. So, wow, I would guess so.
I guess. When he says he's still out there, I mean, he's free?
Yeah, he's on the FBI's most wanted list.
He's disappeared in the wind.
Yep. I guess so.
That sounds interesting.
Yep. So his charges are first-degree murder for the three family members, unlawful flight, and first-degree arson.
Wow.
So, yes, that sounds really interesting. And he's still wanted. So I always think when they're wanted, it's good to bring the case up so people are thinking about it.
I agree.
And I'm sure we could share the description as well. I'm sure they have pictures and sketches and things. So we can help with that. So, yes, thank you, Teddy. I will definitely cover that case.
Okay. I have a comment from Lisa the Cat Dude. This is about Gypsy Rose. So Lisa says, as a member of the disabled community, this story makes me angry and makes my blood boil in a number of ways. Disabled folk already struggle with getting basic needs met, and sometimes even getting doctors to believe us. There is also a new fun trend of able-bodied folk thinking disabled strangers are faking just so we can use access tools like disabled parking and scooters in grocery stores. So this able-bodied woman was out there doing all the things real disabled people are accused of all the time, and on top of that, she's torturing her daughter, making her go through procedures she didn't need, and is probably going to inevitably kill her daughter. Yeah, this story makes me pretty angry.
And I think it should. It's a terrible thing.
Yeah, we didn't dwell too much on that aspect of it, but I can see from a disabled person's point of view how shitty a thing this is.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Using those charities like she did and everything. Terrible. I have a case suggestion from Amanda M. She says she loves our podcast, so that's great. I would love for you to cover the case of Rhonda Morrison from Monroeville, Alabama. Late 1980s, early 1990s, she was a pretty 18-year-old white girl working at a cleaner's, raped and killed one Saturday morning. Walter McMillan, a black man, was convicted and sentenced to death row, basically because two white men implicated him. Later, he was exonerated. The case is unsolved. There was a book written on it, Circumstantial Evidence. I hope my information is accurate because I'm going strictly by memory. Thank you. So I looked up this case, and Walter McMillan got out of prison after prosecutors conceded that he'd spent 6 years on Alabama's death row because of perjured testimony and evidence withheld from his lawyers. So this is really interesting, and I think that's another one that's worthy of covering for sure. So thanks, Amanda.
Another one. See, we always get great suggestions.
We do, and it really takes a lot of... We don't have to think too much about cases because people do it for us.
People find them out for us.
Wonderful.
That's right. Okay, here's another possible case. This is from Jacob's Voice. This is about the William Tyrrell abduction.
Okay.
Thanks for doing this story. An Aussie story with child protection failures involved. You do need to look now back into this. With the foster mother's story changing, the length of the driveway with the amount of time she claims to have taken her eyes off William, and other facts that just do not add up. This year's suppression has been lifted, and we can now say he's a foster child. There is much criticism for the press deliberately misleading the public into thinking he disappeared from his biological family. Well, yeah, we thought so.
They did try and make it look that way, and then they kind of didn't want to say anything. It was weird.
Right. Now, the court has now presumed he is deceased.
Really? Just because he's been gone so long?
Because it's been so long.
Well, I hate to admit it, but just hearing that they're foster parents makes me more suspicious of them. I know that's probably not fair to all the wonderful foster parents out there, but...
Yeah, I think you'd better tread lightly there.
Well, I'm just being honest. It makes me think that way. I'm not saying it's right.
Now, Jacob's Voice has a suggestion about the Braxton Slager Lewin story. This is another foster child. He drowned in the backyard swimming pool after he was taken into temporary foster custody in Sydney. His parents are demanding answers about alleged shortcomings in the state's foster care system after their almost 2-year-old son died at the home in the pool. So the foster carer found him floating unconscious in a small backyard pool. Despite desperate attempts by a neighbor to resuscitate him, he was pronounced dead at the hospital. Autopsy reports said police who attended the home found that the pool fence did not have a self-latching gate and that the home was not safe or secure for young children placed under foster care. The father of the child said that he had seen pictures from the coroner showing beer cans, medication, and rubbish strewn throughout the home and its backyard. So his parents are demanding how a system designed to protect vulnerable children could have led to their beloved son's death.
So not really for our podcast, but definitely interesting, right?
It is really interesting.
Although child neglect is a crime. Yeah.
I think we'll put it up there think about it.
You can consider it. Okay, so I have a note from Karen S. She's a longtime listener, and she's talking to us about remember we did the Tim Bosma case?
Yeah, the Canadian guy.
Yeah, it was a thrill
buyers.
Kill.
Yeah.
Yeah, by Dellen Millard and Mark Smitch. So she's just giving us an update. Dellen Millard and Mark Smitch were found guilty of murder one in the murder of Laura Babcock. Just now, this is recent. And that's Dellen's ex-girlfriend, if you remember her. So she talks about how we covered the murder of Tim Bosma, and she thought we might like to know about this because it's shocking to hear what the jury didn't know when the jurors went off to deliberate. So she sent me some links, and she wanted us to know that there's a trial upcoming in March for Millard for the murder of his father, too, which we talked about a little bit. It was declared a suicide, but there was some suspicion there.
There was some more than suspicion, right?
I think so. So this is interesting. So I'm going to look into that. And we might want to talk about the other murders in another episode at some point.
Yeah, I think so.
This is a super interesting case and just 3 murders we're talking about now. But I'm glad that these are getting looked into and being addressed in the court system. And also, Karen wishes us and our loved ones a warm and happy Christmas full of wonder and joy.
Well, thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Karen. And we would say to all of our listeners, happy holidays. We're going to play our holiday song from Kate in New York on next week's episode. Is that around? That's the day after Christmas?
Next, yes.
Yeah. So we'll play it that week.
We will.
Okay.
Good deal.
Okay.
Okay. I got a case suggestion from Alex A. The story of Farah Frata's murder by her husband, Robert. Says is a particularly galling one for me. The video footage of Robert Frata smirking and primping for the cameras only hours after his wife's murder makes Scott Peterson look like a grief-stricken husband by comparison.
Wow.
Then there's also Frata's horrible sexual deviancy and what, in my view, is an utterly broken appeals process. This case was a Kelly Siegler death row conviction, which some federal judge threw out on what struck me as ludicrous grounds. Fortunately, the perpetrator was reconvicted and stayed on death row where he committed suicide before another judge could turn him loose. There's a few TV documentaries about the case on YouTube, but probably the best resource is a true crime book by Bill G. Cox, which is a short, simple read called No Safe Place. Take care and keep up the great work. This was the mother of 3 young kids. She was 33 years old when she was shot twice in the head after driving into her garage.
Wow.
Neighbors saw the gunman flee the house and jump into a car driven by an accomplice. Now, Farah and her husband, Robert, were in the midst of a nasty divorce and were fighting over custody of their 3 kids. So, yeah, it looks like a very interesting case.
So when did this happen? About what time? Is this recent?
The 2000s.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like something we'd be interested
in. Let's do it. That sounds like a good case.
For some reason, the spouse killings interest me.
Well, is there something
just
I'm
letting
looking
you know.
For? Okay.
So I have one more piece of feedback from Katishka, and she writes all this great stuff about us and about our podcast. She likes them, but I'm not going to read that. Anyway, I want to say thank you very much, though. But one thing she wanted to do was pass along 3 crime stories that she thinks we'd be interested in and that she'd love to hear on the podcast. She hasn't really seen much done on them, and she'd love to get our take on them. So I'm just going to talk about one of them here in the interest of time, and that is the murder of Junko Furuta. And this is a crime that happened in Japan. It's a 17-year-old Japanese high school student who was abducted, tortured, raped, and murdered in the late 1980s. Her murder case was named concrete-encased high school girl murder case. Due to her severely mutilated body being discovered in a concrete drum filled with 208 liters of concrete.
Whoa.
The murder was mainly perpetrated by four teenage boys. About 100 people knew about her captivity, but either did nothing about it or themselves participated in the torture and murder. Most of the participants were friends of the teenage boys who were low-ranking members of the Yakuza. Is that a gang or something?
Like the Japanese crime syndicate.
So this seems like kind of a heartbreaker.
It sure does.
Anything where people are ganging up on one person, and it is upsetting. But it's definitely interesting, and there's plenty on it. Even though it happened in Japan, there's plenty of written English information we can find on it. So.
Well, it's an intriguing case.
Yeah, so that's going to go in our to-do pile.
Okay.
So everything's going in the to-do pile today.
Boy, we got a pile.
So good job.
We've got all of March done now.
Yeah, so thank you so much for your feedback. And until next time, we will see you at the quiet end.
You and me and Santa.
Yes.
Okay.
All of us.
Let's take care of him.
Okay, we will.
All right.
All right.
Bye, guys. Bye.